Good morning, historians from around the internet. Welcome back to the Old History Podcast, where, as always, the goal is to just talk about history and maybe somebody somewhere will learn something. So, right now I'm taking a break from writing a script for a new video. For all my people listening to the podcast, you guys get an early ear as to what's going on. It's going to be over Cherokee Lake and what's under it. That's a very deep subject, so, but I don't intend on the video being too long. I'm going to try to make it a short video. It's really interesting, you know, looking at all this stuff. I found some really neat pictures that you're going to see in the video, too. So I'm really, really excited to make it, and Warren Doctor's excited to watch it, too. He grew up in Granger County. No other updates for Old History at this time. Hope you guys enjoyed the two podcasts you got last week. So, as always, if you like and want to support your favorite internet historian, you can subscribe to the podcast. It isn't required, but it just helps me out. But let's dive right in, shall we? Alright, so last week we covered the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists and the Shays Rebellion. And then the week before that, we covered trying to ratify a constitution. So this week, we're going to look at the state-by-state process. Just taking a little bit closer look at the Constitution. And then we're going to get into George Washington's presidency. Having a hard time talking this morning. And so, as always, one of the sources is U.S. History. Full credit to whoever writes their articles. They deserve a raise. And then we're going to whitehouse.gov and Mount Vernon. All right. So, the ratification process started when the Congress turned the Constitution over to the state legislatures for consideration through specially elected state conventions of the people. Five state conventions voted to approve the Constitution almost immediately between December 1787 and January the following year, 1788. And in all of them, the vote was unanimous. Delaware, New Jersey, Georgia, and then, you know, which was lopsided, Pennsylvania and Connecticut. Clearly, the well-organized Federalists began the contest in pretty strong fashion, and you got to give them credit. You know, they were very organized in what they were doing, as opposed to the Anti-Federalists, who were just kind of winging it. You know, they secured pretty rapidly five of the nine required states needed to make the Constitution law, and it seemed to have, up until a certain point, you know, pretty popular support. And a closer look at who ratified the Constitution in these early states and how it was done indicates that the contest might have been much closer than it would appear at just regularly looking at it. Four of the five states to first ratify were small states that stood to benefit from a strong national government that could restrain abuses by their larger neighbors. The process in Pennsylvania, the one large early ratifier, was nothing less than corrupt. Pennsylvania State Assembly was about to have its turn come to an end. It had begun to consider calling a special convention on the Constitution, even before Congress had forwarded it to the states. Anti-Federalists in the State Assembly tried to block this move by refusing to attend the last 2 days of the session, since without them, there would not be enough members present to make the state legislature a binding legal decision. As a result, an extraordinarily coercive measures were taken to force the Anti-Federalists to attend. And they were found at their boarding houses and then dragged through the streets of Pennsylvania, reportedly, and deposited in the Pennsylvania State House, and that's pretty funny. Now, what you could get by with back in those days, legally. And the doors were locked behind them, so the presence of these Anti-Federalists against their will created the required number of members to allow the special convention to be called in state, which eventually voted 46-23 to accept the Constitution. The first test of the Constitution in an influential state with both sides prepared for the contest came in Massachusetts in 1788. Influential patriots like John Hancock and Samuel Adams led the Anti-Federalists. Further, the rural western part of the state where Shays' Rebellion had occurred the previous year was an Anti-Federalist stronghold. A divided month-long debate ensued that ended with a close vote of 187-168 in favor of the Constitution. Crucial to this narrow victory was the strong support of artisans who favored new commercial powers of the cheap proposed central government that might raise tariffs, taxes, on cheap British imports that threatened their livelihood. The Federalists' narrow victory in Massachusetts rested on a cross-class alliance between nationalist and urban working men. Massachusetts' vote also included an innovation with broad significance. John Hancock, who shifted his initial opposition to the Constitution, led the move towards ratification. Satisfied that certain amendments protecting individual rights were going to be considered by the first new Congress that would meet should the Constitution become law. The compromise helped carry the narrow victory in Massachusetts and was adopted by every subsequent state convention to ratify, except Maryland. By spring, conventions in the required nine states had ratified and the Constitution would become law. But with powerful populists and highly divided Virginia and New York yet to vote, the legitimacy of the new national system had not yet fully been resolved. The convention in Virginia began its debate. Hold on, I'm still recording. There we are. Began its debate before the nine states had approved the Constitution. Sorry about that. But the contest was so close and bitterly fought that it lasted past the point where the technical number needed to ratify had been reached. Nevertheless, Virginia's decision was crucial to the nation. And who could imagine the early history of the United States if Virginia had not joined the Union? And there are a lot of what-ifs that surround this. Like, what if Thomas Jefferson and James Madison had not been allowed to hold a national political office? In the end, Virginia approved the Constitution with recommended amendments in an especially close vote to 89-79. Only one major state would remain. The Constitution was getting close to the broad support that it needed to be effective. And no state was as deeply divided, perhaps, as New York, where the nationalist urban artisan alliance could carry New York City and the surrounding region, while upstate areas were strongly anti-federalist. The opponents of the Constitution had a strong majority when the convention began and set a tough challenge for Alexander Hamilton, the leading New York Federalist. Hamilton managed a brilliant campaign that would narrowly win the issue 30-27 by combining threat and accommodation. On one hand, he warned that commercial downstate areas might separate from upstate New York if it didn't ratify. On the other hand, he accepted conciliatory path suggested by Massachusetts, amendments that would be acceptable after ratification. The debate in New York produced the most famous exploration of American political philosophy, I cannot talk today, which was called the Federalist Papers. And they were a series of 85 anonymous letters to newspapers, which were co-written by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. And they tried to assure the public of two key points of the Federalist agenda. First, they would explain that a strong government was needed for a variety of reasons, but especially if the United States was able to act effectively in foreign affairs. And then it tried to convince readers that because of the separation of the powers in the central government, there was little chance of the national government evolving into a tyrannical power. Instead of growing ever stronger, the separate branches would provide a check and balance against each other so that none could rise against the other, you know, or they could establish complete dominance. The influence of these newspaper letters in the New York debate is not entirely known, but their status as a classic of American political thought is beyond doubt. Although Hamilton wrote the majority of the letters, James Madison authored the ones that are most celebrated, especially Federalist Paper Number 10. And in this one, Madison argued that a larger republic would not lead to greater abuse of power, as was the common thought. But it would actually work to make a large national republic a defense against tyranny. Madison would explain that the scope of the national republic would prevent local interest from rising to dominance, and therefore a larger scale of itself limited the potential abuse of power by including a diversity of interest. And he identified agriculture, manufacturing, merchants, and creditors as some of them. The different groups in a larger republic would cancel each other out and prevent a corrupt interest from controlling all the others. Madison was one of the first political theorists to offer a profoundly modern vision of self-interest as an aspect of human nature that could be employed to make government better rather than more corrupt. In this, he represents a key figure in the transition from a traditional Republican America to a more liberal one, where self-interest has a necessary role to play in public life. And then we'll take a quick break here, and then we'll get into good old George Washington. Now, one thing to talk about Washington's presidency is that he almost didn't want it. And somebody can correct me here if I'm wrong, but he really just, before he was elected president, he wanted to go to Mount Vernon and retire. But he noticed that the nation that was still operating under the Articles of Confederation wasn't really doing too well. So, and he took steps at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 when the Constitution was ratified. The Electoral College unanimously elected George Washington as president, but we got to get into that a little bit. He was an influential president. He established the title as president, but during his campaign, only 10 of the original 13 colonies voted in the election. Citizens across the colonies, as well as Washington's former comrades in arms, insisted that only he could forge a nation. And in turn, he would win by unanimous electoral vote, both in 1788 and 1792. But the odd thing is that less than 1.3% of the population at that time would vote in the election. He did not infringe upon the policy-making powers that he felt the Constitution gave Congress, but the determination of foreign policy became a presidential concern. When the French Revolution led to a major war between France and England, Washington refused to accept entirely the recommendations of his Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, who was pro-French, or his Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton, who was pro-British. And he insisted upon a neutral course of action until the United States could grow stronger. Because, you got to think about it, and we've covered this over the last couple of weeks now, we just got out of a major war. We were a new nation with almost no money. The war was very expensive and cost farmers and lots of businessmen not just the money that they had, but also some of the food that they'd had, buildings, and they were still trying to recover too. This was only just a few short years after the Revolution had ended. So, he issued a proclamation of neutrality during that. So that way, or basically he just kind of told France, no, I ain't getting involved. So, two parties were developing by the end of his first term. Switching gears here. He was tired of politics, and he retired at the end of his second term. And in his farewell address, he urged the countrymen to forswear excessive party spirit and geographical distinctions in foreign affairs. And he warned against long-term alliances. Now, he would die in December of 1799, only 3 years after he got out of retirement, but some of the challenges he would face would be in domestic affairs, and this was a really, really strong problem here, because as more settlers went west of the Appalachian Mountains, they were confronted by Native Americans. And not just in Tennessee, not just in Kentucky and Virginia, but, in Ohio and out that way, the further out you got, the less and less sparse our settlers got, the more Native Americans they were. So they were confronted, I think it's estimated over 100,000 Native Americans, according to si.edu. So that was a big problem, and we've covered that before, and I'll probably cover it again. But when you get into Tennessee, Native Americans weren't really forced out of here up until around the 1800s, so we were still dealing with that a little bit past that. So near Toledo, Ohio, Washington sent federal troops to fight seven tribes of Native Americans in the Battle of Fallen Timbers in the summer of 1794. Defeated, the seven tribes, the Shawnee, Miami, Ottawa, the Chippewa, Iroquois, the Sauk, and the Fox, relinquished large portions of their land to the United States and then moved west. And I guess this might be almost a foreshadowing event to the Indian Removal Act, but Washington never done anything like that, as far as I know, anyway. In foreign affairs, Britain refused to surrender its western post and also used these to supply the Indians in order to stir up trouble for the U.S. And then, of course, we already talked about the French Revolution, where Britain and France were at war. So he has already put at odds with French supporters like Thomas Jefferson. The other thing he had to deal with was the Spanish port of New Orleans, which had been part of the Spanish Empire. 1794, George Washington would suppress the Whiskey Rebellion when Pennsylvania farmers attacked federal officials after excise tax was imposed in 1791 on whiskey by invoking the power of the federal government over the states. So, just to go over a little bit of what he done, and I'm trying not to just dwell on him here, but he established the title as president and outlined the capacities of office through his example. He started the tradition of inaugural address as well as presidential cabinet, neither prescribed by the Constitution. He wrote and gave a farewell address, which is still relevant today for its call for political unity among Americans. He sided with Alexander Hamilton in a debate on how to fund a nation by imposing taxes and establishing a national bank. Thomas Jefferson bitterly opposed Hamilton, and the two opposing parties formed the Democrat-Republican Party, headed by Jefferson, and the Federalist faction, led by Hamilton. So, that's a little bit about George Washington and how the Constitution got ratified. So, hope you guys enjoyed the Constitution. I hope you guys enjoyed the podcast today. We'll see what next week holds. Thanks for listening.